The following podcast is not relating to my teachings and work at Del Cid Medical Center and is for entertainment purposes only.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of
The Life of Flow.
The Life of Flow podcast. Love it, Miguel. And today we have a super interesting person, a very good friend, Jillian Acosta. And Jillian has a business named the Root Cause.
Root Cause Method.
And Jillian is a registered dietitian, and she's come up with a very innovative way to deal with basically the pandemic that we all deal with, the consequences of, which is basically lifestyle, like what people eat, what people put in their body. And she helps people with that. And it was an amazing conversation. And I guess the main topics of this conversation can be summarized in string cheese and psychedelics.
Stick around, man. It was a great conversation. I hope you guys all like it and enjoy it. And Jilly has made me a believer and a fan and a supporter. So stick around.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.
All right, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Life of Flow podcast. Today we have Jillian.
So accelerated.
Acosta.
Thank you.
And we're going to start off this conversation, Jillian, with a very serious topic, okay?
Which is
string cheese.
Stop. Stop.
String cheese.
Stop.
Okay.
Someone has an addiction.
Someone has an addiction to shitty food.
It's a need. Not an addiction.
Yeah.
Yeah. We can talk about it.
I'm available. Yeah. I think Jillian is on my side, but we're going to leave it there just because I don't want to like trigger your trauma response, okay? All right, Jillian. No, but you are here to talk about one of my favorite subjects, which I think is super important and none of us talk about. And we all kind of like shove to the side, which is nutrition. And I stole a phrase from you, which I thought was very, very smart and very, very insightful. And it's that we all have different ways in which we cope with, you said soothe, with the stress of life. Mm. And, you know, a lot of it can be very unhealthy. And you kind of dedicated, you know, your current career. Now we talked in your transition a little more, but when we met initially, there was a lot of what you're doing of helping people that were struggling with food addiction as a way to soothe, and kind of transmuting and changing that, into something healthier. So the floor is yours.
Yeah. I mean, it's a big part of my work. It's a passion project of sorts, where it was my particular journey where I was using food to try to alter my emotional state. I was using food to distract or dissociate from what I was feeling in the moment, completely subconsciously. And you know, for a while, including in childhood and early, you know, adolescence and adulthood, it served me in many ways. It allowed me to kind of check out from my current situation, especially as a child when I was experiencing a lot of turmoil in the household. And it kind of snowballed out of control and became an eating disorder. And I was in and out of treatment when I was in my early teens. And although those specific patterns around like bulimia stopped, my compulsion around food and the urgency and the frequency in which I was reaching for food to kind of soothe myself, it felt out of control. It didn't go anywhere. And so I just kind of became obsessed with like, what is driving this thing? What's behind this mechanism? Because, you know, on my path, I learned it's not about the food. There is no like actual string cheese addiction. You know, there's no, I don't believe there's an actual like sugar addiction. I think there is an unwillingness to feel. I think there's a big fear of feeling, and we can use whatever substance to kind of satiate that immediate impulse or need, just as we can use food. It's the same thing.
That's super interesting.
Wait, so I can't just be hungry and come home and eat string cheese?
What are you suppressing? About? What is oppressing?
Stop.
There's a difference. There's a big difference between like physical and emotional hunger. I'm happy to break it down. Like physical hunger is typically the physiology will present like cues, right? You'll get like rumbling in your stomach, or you might feel like hypoglycemic, low blood sugar, or like a little loopy. Hopefully it doesn't get to that point. And another way to identify which is present is with physical hunger, many options seem available. You can kind of open the refrigerator and be like, oh, there's some string cheese, or there's my leftovers from last night, or there's a thing I can just whip up. And a lot of things seem palatable and satiating. And then you have your meal and you're kind of satisfied and you carry on with your day. Emotional hunger is typically like it comes on very rapidly, and it's almost always triggered by a thought, and it's very targeted. It's like, I need those cookies, or I need that string cheese. I need that, you know, ice cream that's in the freezer. And it feels like so targeted, where if you don't get that thing, you don't get your fix. You know, it's like you get like a hit almost. And then you may eat that thing and you may stop there. And very likely in emotional context, you don't stop there. It's like one thing leads to the next thing leads to the next until potentially you are uncomfortably full. And you enter into this cycle of like self-loathing, where you now feel like, you know, shame or frustration with yourself. Why did I do that? I have no control. And it becomes this like distractive cycle that is distracting you from the initial trigger, and just a lot of collateral damage in its wake.
You know, there's a ton of conversation around nutrition. There's a Rogan just had a pretty big podcast about it with I forget the names. I think their last names are Miles. They're two. They're brother and sister. Means. Sorry, I've said Miles twice. Means. Yeah, and she was an ENT fellow or resident at Stanford, and they, I guess, quit. And I think now it's in functional medicine. But anyways, it seems like that there's a lot of conversation around it. I see very little data in the world we live in as far as, you know, what is the optimal nutrition. I have a view that is informed on very superficial data that I kind of hold, and I tell my patients, you know, when they come in, I kind of guide them towards basically a zero carb diet, because I know that saying zero carbs, they'll, you know, 40% of their diet is still going to be carbs. That they're probably like 90% of their diet is carbs now. So, you know, 40 is better than 90, but that I don't have very strong data to suggest that. It just seems from what I've read that's probably the best thing. What do you think as far as, you know, from a cardiovascular standpoint, like a diabetes standpoint, which is like a huge thing that's going on in our culture and our country and in the world, the Western world, go ahead.
I think it's multifactorial. For sure, there's like the physiological component, where if the majority of your plate is carbohydrates, refined carbohydrates, high starchy or high glycemic food, naturally insulin levels are elevated, glucose levels, insulin levels are elevated. We know that insulin is a fat storage hormone. We know by its very nature that body fat is inflammatory. It's pro-inflammatory. So the more adipose we have, the more at risk we are for chronic illness. You know, hypertension, diabetes, cancers, et cetera. And so that's just like obvious, that's undeniable, irrefutable in the literature. But where I'm like, what I'm fascinated by is like, why are we doing this? If we know that, like, you know, Kellogg's is not ideal, for example, like what has us continue to reach for the Kellogg's? And that's kind of a different tangent. I'm not sure if you want to go there, but like, when I teach clients about building your plate, it's interesting. My general recommendation is usually that 40% of the plate in terms of volume is a high quality protein, grass-fed beef, wild-caught fish, you know, free-range chicken, 40%. So that's way more than the RDA. That's way more. That for me is like harshly inadequate. We need way more protein than what is recommended. by my governing body, which, you know, I disagree with, obviously. And so 40% of it is from a high quality source of protein. And then 50% of it is non-starchy carbohydrates. So like, you know, a beautiful stir fry with tons of different vegetables like artichoke and peppers and spinach and kale and all the things, like all the colors, rich in antioxidants, really high in fiber, which we know helps decrease cholesterol and mitigate risk of other illnesses like diabetes. And then 10% of the volume is fat, and it's a beautiful source of fat. So it's like the high quality oil that you're using to cook with, or that's, you know, drizzled over your salad, or olives or avocado, those kinds of things. And that's like a very rough kind of, here's how you can design your plate, plug and play. When I give a client a protocol, I like color code. Here's, you know, protein's always green. If 40% of your plate has to be from green protein, like here are your options. Like I just make it, and I'm happy to send that to you so you can just disperse it to your client or your patients rather. And it's like, there's so much information. ChatGPT can pull up a beautiful meal plan based on your physiology and biomarkers, I'm sure, and or another algorithmic program can. And it's like, that's great. Knowledge is really great, but it's like, that doesn't necessarily translate into application. That doesn't really necessarily influence our actual behavior.
Why is it that there's so much disparity between these regulations from country to country? It seems like for the standards of what we all think are really good, the US of A seems to be fairly below nutritional standards of other countries. You know, some of the shit that we give our babies here is against the law in some European countries. Mexico, let's not go that far away. Mexico has a massive, like, there's these black stamps on the Mexican Cokes, for example, that Lucas likes to drink, right? Because they're high caloric, but they have these very thing. There's these big black things that say, it's alto en calorías. High cardiovascular risk.
Yeah.
And then it says high diabetes risk and yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
But yet in America, which we, you know, go around thinking we're like this amazing country that everything's done right. When it comes to food, we are pretty fucking sucky. But we allow it, right? I mean, to your point, cereals for kids. The stuff I feed my kid, I'm psychotic about Lucas. By the way, my kid's got nothing to do with this one, but his name is Lucas.
And well, now, you love him so much.
I love my Lucas a lot.
He loves the
this one I love sometimes. But it really, when you're feeding a human that's growing, you realize how important what they're putting in their mouth is. And I freak out about just buying a packet that you have no idea what's behind. Door number one. Like you have no idea.
Yeah. It's just like, imagine, I don't know.
Anyway, it was like a monologue/question, but is there do you understand, Jillian, why is it that America is like, what are the powers that be that allow America to be so callous about this?
Capitalism.
There's capitalism in Mexico. There's capitalism in Europe. I don't think that explains all of it. No,
there's got to be some people that have really gone to town, right? I mean, I think the lobbyists here, I think the food industry lobbying at the Hill has to be something incredible.
Novo Nordisk, who invented this drug that, what is it? Like Ozempic is from Europe. It's a European company.
What does that have to do with the food and beverage?
Everything.
But I'm pretty sure the standards and the application of use over in that country is much more regulated than it is here. Like, my perspective is like, there's this element of like anything goes over here, and people are creating things and capitalizing on how we consume them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that it's in the zeitgeist. Like nutrition's in the zeitgeist. It's in the zeitgeist that...
What does that mean? Sorry.
The zeitgeist is kind of like the ether. It's in the culture.
Okay. Field.
That these companies are killing us with the food. that processed food is literally poisoning us.
Yeah.
We know it. It's the truth. We can all sense it. My dad stopped eating Cheerios like recently. I was like, oh, thank God that you're not eating fucking like carbs for breakfast. He used to tell me the American Heart Association says it's good. It's like,
I know. Oh,
Jesus Christ.
I know.
So people get it, but what's the disconnect from like mass adoption or like mass realization and action on like, oh, I shouldn't eat this shit that has this little cartoon in a box trying to convince me to eat it.
It's interesting. You know, I think I'm reminded of my grandmother. My grandmother right now is like 85 years old and she laughs with me and she's like, you know, I don't remember exactly what she says, but it's something along the lines of like, how did I live to be this age if I was eating all these kinds of foods? And my answer is always like the quality of the food has declined substantially in your lifetime, mm-hmm. mine, and a fraction of the amount of, you know, time she's been here. It's like the contamination with glyphosate and other carcinogenic pesticides and herbicides and what it's doing from an endocrinology standpoint to a gastrointestinal standpoint, systemically, really. It's happened over the past, since the 80s. And so like, there's been this loyalty, there's been this desire to trust these brands. And I think that's like the Trojan horse situation where there's trust established. I've been eating Wheaties for years and years, and now all of a sudden it's poisonous, but it wasn't before. So there's this, yeah, this like embedded kind of trust. And also in my perspective, sometimes voluntary, sometimes not. A level of ignorance. Like there are people in food deserts that really don't know. They don't have access to this information. They don't listen to this podcast. You know, my heart hurts for them because like they really don't have a lot of option, financially, and don't have a lot of education. And then there's this, the other sphere of like the people that do have access to this, and a lot of them are waking up and a lot of them are making changes, and some of them are resistant. And in my perspective, when there is resistance, there is this kind of, you know, food. Food is a very interesting topic because it serves as this like sense of comfort, especially, you know, when it's utilized in that way. And so telling people they have to get on a diet, telling people they're not allowed to have their favorite snack that brings that level of comfort, it's confronting. And so there is this like chosen, like, no, I don't buy that, because they want to stay with their comfort.
Yeah. All right. So
one of the things that I found the most revealing in this matter, is I want to say about 7 years ago, I had to give a grand rounds on the state of peripheral arterial disease in Latin America. And I remember that at the time I, you know, consumed a bunch of scientific papers on the matter. And one of the things that I thought was the most interesting was that there was this guy by the last name Folks, Fowekes. And so Folks had run an analysis on the change on diet and body mass index within a 10-year frame. And when they were analyzing Latin America, they ultimately grabbed Latin America and they changed it, because they just couldn't put Latin America in a single region. And mm-hmm. I think probably the US fits in that panel. But what I want to say with that was they couldn't treat the region as one, because when they did the regression analysis of all these variables, these are obviously very convoluted studies with, you know, millions of people. What they realized was that there was a driver of economic stability as one of the main variables that determined what the presence of the prevalence of disease was, of atherosclerosis in their blood vessels in their legs was, but related to diabetes and likely related to obesity. And what these authors concluded essentially was that the poor Latin America, the people that have financial constraints and can't necessarily go to the most remarkable places to buy their basic foods would probably gravitate towards McDonald's as the easiest source of, you know, 1500 calories mm-hmm. on a 10 minute break.
Yeah.
And that led to obesity, and then obesity led to insulin resistance, which then eventually led to peripheral arterial disease. And so the way that they ended up doing the study was not necessarily an economic study, but they had to change and they had to analyze Latin America in two. It was the high income Latin America and the low income Latin America. Mm-hmm. And I genuinely think that that's at least how it started. There may be a degree of, and this is what I fear the most, which is there is a degree of ignorance that goes into this mix. Okay. But which is going to be hard to change because, you know, not ignorance, education is going to be hard to massify. But then also, even if you do teach me, what about the fact that it's more expensive to buy mm-hmm. a righteous meal than to get a happy meal?
Yeah. I think the price difference, I disagree completely in the education ignorance thing. I don't think of my patients as like having less of a capacity to understand, or that they understand less than I do, because we all have
but
this.
That's not
they
the
all
definition have this of ignorance. Thing. But that's not the definition of ignorance. Ignorance is just lack of access to the understanding, well, not the incapacity to understand.
I think
they've never been educated.
Yeah, but there's people that are highly educated with degrees and stuff like that that have the same problems, that are morbidly obese, and
so
they have.
You don't
again,
think? Let me just to be understand yeah. to be clear. You don't think financial status yeah. dictates a significant portion of dietary limitations or dietary requirements?
No, I agree. Well, I think financial status does, as far as like what can you buy, right. what if you get government subsidies, what those subsidies mm-hmm. buy you mm-hmm. for sure. That mm-hmm. has a degree. I don't think people know less than I do. Or a lot of them know less than I do as far as like what is right for them to eat. I think all of us kind of are getting there. It's just, you can't, the ideas are unstoppable. This idea is coming to the front. And, you know, I just don't think that people don't have it in their mind that they haven't completely incorporated, because I think there's a difference between knowing something rationally and feeling it as true. I think there's a disconnect there. But everyone has all the information that has ever existed in the world in their pocket. Every single
And the reality
human,
is these conditions are spread across all demographics.
Exactly.
They're rampant in all demographics. So yeah, there's absolutely a socioeconomic variable here, where in those populations there are absolutely substantially elevated numbers of people with these conditions, but it's not exclusive to those populations.
Yeah, I think there's a huge cultural component too, because when I was in San Antonio, I would tell people, hey man, you can't eat 10 tortillas a day. Your leg is going to fall off. They would look at me like I'm crazy. They was like, what do you mean I can't eat tortillas? It's like, yeah, you can't eat them every day, bro. Just eat them on Sundays or something. But they're like, yeah, I can eat 10, 20 tortillas in a day. I was like, well, that's, you know, what are we doing here? Like, what are you coming here for? You know, like I can do surgery all day, but if you keep eating tortillas, this is going to keep happening. kind of a deal. But anyways, do you mind talking a little bit more kind of like the interesting modalities that you apply for these that are kind of off the normal dietary track?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'll start by saying like food is a really, as I mentioned, a really, really interesting substance, because if someone struggles with their relationship with alcohol or narcotics or whatever, they can omit that substance from their life. They become sober. But food, we cannot do that. That's another condition, obviously, anorexia nervosa. Like, we have to learn to navigate with this particular substance. And it's very complex. Like, it's the thing that bonded us to our mothers or created maybe a sense of abandonment if we weren't nursed and breastfed as children. Or it's the thing that brings families together in celebration or allows you to feel the love from your grandmother's baking. It can also be the source of comfort and distraction, like I've already named. Like, it has a lot of charge to it. And so people's relationships are quite intimate. They're very intimate with food. It's a thing that can both keep us alive and kill us. It can be medicinal and it can also be toxic. And so to unpack one's relationship with food, especially someone who's carrying excess weight, especially someone who's diagnosed with these chronic conditions, as we've already touched on, it's like, it's one thing to say, okay, follow this diet. It's another thing to actually do it. It's not a matter of information for a small population. Yeah. But a lot of us have access to the information. So it's like, what is preventing the follow through of actually adhering to a diet that promotes the remission of conditions? And for me, that looks very emotional. It looks very trauma informed. And so I use psychedelics in my work as a dietitian to unpack one's relationship with food. What has food represented? What purpose has food served? Where is there a sense of loss of control or disempowerment around food and one's sovereignty and ability to make choices that really strengthen them and heal them? And so I use ketamine in my practice. Ketamine is obviously an FDA approved psychedelic. Every single client of mine is prescribed this by a qualified prescriber. And I'm essentially holding the space in a program that I have that's called The Garden, which is a three plus month coaching container where on weeks 5, 7, and 9, they're sitting in this altered state of consciousness to really unpack this relationship. And ultimately, you know, my perspective is that people don't struggle with food. I actually don't believe in the term like food addiction or sugar addiction. I think that it has way more to do with one's unwillingness to feel discomfort. It has way more to do with our kind of dissociative mechanisms of, like, you know, which could be anything. It could be scrolling on Instagram or tuning out to Netflix, and it's not anything inherently wrong with those patterns. It's just the intention behind them. How are they being used? There's nothing wrong with cookies in the pantry. But if you are coming home from work, super stressed out, miserable, hating your job and needing to just check out, and you down a bag of cookies, that says something to me. It speaks a lot to me. And so that's what I want to unpack. And in my work, I've witnessed people lose upwards of 40 pounds in this 3-month program, not because I put them on a rigid diet, but because I'm teaching them how to feel. Because when you're willing to feel something uncomfortable and you feel safe enough to feel that thing, you no longer need the cookies to numb it. You no longer really need any substance to tell you the truth after that. And that's when sustainable weight loss happens and so many other incredible benefits.
So are all your clients already essentially referred to this particular program with ketamine, or this is something you reserve for a percentage of clients?
I have a couple of different offerings in my practice. This one in particular there's an option. It's a coaching container. It's a coaching program. If people decide to utilize ketamine in conjunction with the coaching, the effects are profound and transformational. They're still transformational without this, but obviously leveraging the properties of the medicine allows us to really uproot some serious programming, if you will. And so, yeah, it's never enforced or mandatory, but the majority of the clients who come through this program opt in.
So who would you say is your perfect client? If you could choose, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of varieties, but who's a perfect client for this program?
I love this. It's the person who's been battling resignation. It's the person, man or woman, I work with both, who are frustrated with themselves, their lives. There's a lack of fulfillment. There's a frustration or self-consciousness with their body. It's impeding on their quality of life. They feel disempowered, maybe disconnected from themselves. It's the client who wants more and recognizes that there's this disconnection with themselves, this kind of tendency of like self-deprecation, self-abuse in many ways. Their physiology varies. Some of them carry excess weight, some of them don't, but there's still this disempowerment around food and this distrust in themselves and that kind of presentation. And it's the one who wants out of that.
Quick break coming up. Stay with us for something to add more flow to your life.
Hey guys, this is Miguel and Lucas, and we wanted to talk to you about a super interesting project.
Name of this project is Amputation Nation. It's going to be a 6-part documentary series, and we definitely want you to look at it, watch it, digest it, support it.
Yeah, so visit amputationnationthemovie.org to support and give love to these people that are doing a great job.
Without a doubt, we're underdiagnosing peripheral arterial disease. It has not gotten the attention that it should.
Every 4 minutes, there is an amputation in this country due to PAD and diabetes. We also know that 85% of these amputations are preventable.
There is good care available here. Closed minds are what we have to get rid of.
Thank you for staying with us. Now let's get back to the show.
There's this concept of like, then this being talked a lot about, I guess, I don't know if metabolic dysfunction or am I correct there? Is that kind of the terms used?
Yeah, metabolic dysfunction is a heart disease, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I've heard people talk about this and say that, you know, this diabetes is just a reflection of that metabolic dysfunction. If we say that that's true, and, you know, how many people in the U.S. have diabetes? What percent of the U.S. population? Greater than 30%, probably.
For sure.
What's that? Yeah, for adults. So that's a shit ton of people. That's like probably close to 80 million people, maybe, doing some rough math. Of those, how many of those do you think does your program address? Like, what percentage of adults that have just this type of metabolic dysfunction led to from just what they eat, their lack of exercise and such, would benefit from such a program as yours? Do you have an insight into that? I'm trying to get to the point of, you know, if we're thinking about solutions, because we as a society as a society of vascular surgeons, or as a group of vascular surgeons, we're not talking about this at all. So when we talk about these problems, we talk about, you know, implementation in a mass scale. Just kind of addressing that, like, how do we, because what you're doing is very niche, it's very well thought out, it's very nuanced, but like, how do we reach that? Have you thought about the masses? How do we cause scale outside of a group, you know, of subselect the people that come to you? I don't know. It just seems like a daunting thing to think
it,
about.
It does seem daunting, and it also, it feels like the only place I know where to start is where I'm starting.
Yeah.
You know, and I have transitioned from a lot of one-on-one work to now more group dynamic for larger impact. And it is still small scale because this work is so nuanced, it's so personalized. You know, we're talking about people's, you know, childhood experiences and relationship to self, and so to kind of broadcast those messages on a large scale, it feels like it would be easily dismissed. So I don't know if I have the answer to that. I think it's just, yeah. I think it's more group work. I think it is, you know, my family dynamic has changed a lot, to be quite honest, I was the first one to kind of take the plunge. I was the first one to go on this path of deep exploration and excavation. And because I started to behave differently because of what I was navigating and how I was expanding, other people in my family started to kind of jump on the same bandwagon. And so if we can't necessarily tackle the masses, then the people that are the change makers in their communities or in their family units, they have the capacity to create the ripple effect. And so it feels like I'm doing what I can right now and have every intention of scaling this thing. And like, I know I can't be the only one, and I'm not, you know?
Do you have a lot of other dietitians reaching out to you?
I have started to coach like coaches and other dietitians in the way that I blend the physiological support with the deep emotional, psychological, even spiritual, thing, the modalities. It's all one thing. It's, you know, emotional eating is an expression of something. It's a symptom. It's not the actual problem. Same thing with eating disorders. There, it's a symptom. And so, let's go to the roof.
Do you have a team of people involved in the program, or is it you do most of the heavy lifting? You do the talking, you do the therapy, you do the diet adjustments. And then you obviously bring the provider and the healthcare person to, you know, give the dose of ketamine that needs to be done. But then you're really kind of the one that's creating this kind of magic, or is there a therapist? Is there a psychologist? You just kind of sit on your corner with giving them the advice on the diet. Like, walk me a little bit through what this program means.
Yeah, I have people in my sphere where if there's something someone is processing that feels above my scope, I will refer them out. Okay. But I do it all.
Because I'm sure from, like, inevitably, it just feels like when I talk to my patients, I say, you know, they're like, oh, my legs hurt. And I'm like, okay, well, here we go, right? I mean, it could be vascular, but it could be orthopedic, it could be neurologic, it could be, you know, blah, 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 blah. And so I always say, listen, leg pain could be like a sneeze, right? You sneeze because you got a booger in the wrong place, or because you have an allergy, or because you're about to get, you know, the flu. And so I feel that food, being as important as it is for your pure existence, could be the ultimate downstream manifestation of so many things that may potentially be, right? I mean, did they get abused as kids, and this is now today 20, 30, 40 years popping up as a problem, and you start scraping some of those levels, and all of a sudden you start revealing some pretty hardcore stuff that may be a little bit over just, oh, this is a dietary problem. No, this guy's fucked up from the very conception of his, you know, childhood. And I'm sure that you've come across things like that where all of a sudden it was like, okay, well, this is something this that is, I need to, yeah, right?
This,
I
mean, is, but my work.
But thankfully for that person, right? Because otherwise nobody would have ever found that. But I'm just saying, you probably stumble on, okay, we're going to start this because this guy thinks he has a problem with food, but God, he was probably touched at some point as a kid. You know, like something super fucking horrible that could be the end result of this whole problem. You don't agree?
I agree.
But I think people start going down that rabbit hole.
Yeah, I just wonder. But go ahead.
But I want your answer on this, because I'm sure you've seen some pretty wild and dark things.
Not only have I seen wild, this is why I attract it. I had an eating disorder my entire life. It ranged from bulimia, anorexia, binge eating disorder. Since the time I was 3 years old, I was using food to self-soothe. Mm-hmm. I didn't have language for it, but I was absolutely obsessed with candy and deep dish pizza because I lived in Detroit. I was obsessed with it. I wrote it in my school papers, and I had no idea why. In 2020, I sat in an ayahuasca experience and learned that I was molested between the ages of 3 and 5 years old, and I had no idea. No idea until I learned my story, and everything in my entire life made sense. And I went into solitude for 2 years, and I just learned and harvested wisdom and codes, if you will. And so the people that have experienced this, unbeknownst to them sometimes, find me, and we do this deep work, and they experience radical transformations that change their lives. So this is exactly what
you don't. So you don't run away from that?
No way. I know exactly how to hold it.
Okay. Because I was about to say at the beginning or you know, a while ago, I said, who's the best project? Who's the best client? And then I was going to say, who's the worst client? Like, who's the one that you don't want? But, you know, is there a worse client or is there just a greater challenge to deal with?
Okay. I have been on many consultations, like the kind of the sales call before we decide to work together with people who are clinically obese and tell me that they don't have an emotional relationship with food. So if I had to kind of identify an archetype of someone who I would struggle a lot to work with, it would be them, the people that just have no concept of what, you know, a distorted relationship with food really looks like. But I don't typically, there's not resonance with those people. They're not interested in working with me. And fortunately I can't exhaust myself to try to convince them of something. It's the client that is like, I know I have this thing. I can't get on top of it. I need support. And that's my client. And it's just this willingness and honestly, this hunger for something greater, for liberation from these things. That's my person.
But uncovering these very complex layers after layers after layers of things is not something that disincentivizes you. If anything, it's something that gives more meaning to your project and ultimately allows you to provide sustainable change, right? Because at the end of the day, it's getting to why. It's the why. It's you know, you don't know why when you start, but I bet you that when you get to it, you start revealing be it ketamine, be it shrooms, be it ayahuasca, be it whatever it is, it is finding a way to unlock a lot of these probably embedded, very protective mechanisms of sociological defense.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know,
in the literature, it's referred to as attempted emotional regulation. It's using something outside of ourselves in an attempt to regulate our severely dysregulated nervous systems. And if I can help guide someone into creating a solid baseline in nervous system regulation, creating safety within themselves to feel something uncomfortable. You know, this is one of my favorite things about ketamine because it is a subanesthetic dissociative. It allows for example, in a ketamine experience, fear gets elicited. All of a sudden it's like, oh wow, like this is what fear feels like in my body. Like, I wonder, you know, what fear has to teach me. It's not like this hijack of fear. They're not taken by the experience. They're not kind of being reinforced that they can't handle it. It's the opposite. It's like, oh, wow, I can be with this feeling. I don't have to check out. I don't have to go eat. My capacity of being with something challenging and uncomfortable is expanding in real time. And then we nurture that process. We nurture that muscle, if you will. And that starts to lend itself to other, you know, ordinary states of consciousness, especially around food and cravings and otherwise. And it's incredible.
Do you as a shaman, are you there?
I don't know. She's the shaman.
No.
I would call myself that.
I said, as the shamans do, that they're there with you because they, you know, everybody that's been there, all of us that at some point in time have, there is not only the medication or the particle, the molecule, whatever changes your neurotransmitters. But it is also the hums and the songs and the things and the visions and the lights and the way that you get into that very deep state and then the pastoring through that and allowing you to then come back in, right? We've had conversations with the guys in Austin that are doing this professionally and running FDA studies, but the importance of the reconnection and the landing zone at the end of the trip. I'm not saying you're a shaman, but are you part of that when your clients or patients or whatever you need to call them are through this? Are you present in that? Or is that something that you don't necessarily you know, become involved
with? I'm very much present, just not in the physical sense, meaning we, okay. It's similar to like at home ketamine company, like models, like New okay. Life, Journey Clinical, where they get prescribed the medicine and they have the option to do it in the comfort of their own home. So they have okay. the medicine and they may opt to have like a solo journey, but I am the one guiding the space. So on a video call on a platform that's still HIPAA compliant, it's still secure, I am on a 3-hour call with these clients. And so the first 30 minutes is a lot of communication, speaking about what's alive, maybe what's some apprehensions or some excitement, speaking intention, and then opening up the ceremony space, because even though it's a synthetic, it's still sacred space. It is still absolutely.
Do you like the nomenclature of ceremony instead of therapy?
It's a ritual. Yeah, okay. It's sacred space. I still treat it as that. Yeah. Okay. I don't serve other medicines. I've not been invited by other medicines, and I also have a license, and so like I don't dabble in those other ones, but with ketamine, everything is above ground, and so I still treat it as it's a ceremony because it is sacred space. And a lot of the people that I work with, they've never really explored many other psychedelics. Some have, but a lot haven't. And it becomes this like really, really beautiful on-ramp to altered states of consciousness, because it's not like ayahuasca where you're totally taken in the abstract land of Mother Aya. Like it's a milder journey. It's much more, it's gentler. And that's one of the other, my favorite qualities about ketamine is that like for people who have experienced complex trauma, like myself, whenever I go into an ayahuasca or a mushroom experience or something, my nervous system is generally contracted. I'm like afraid. Even though I trust the medicine and I trust myself, I don't know if I'm going to be shown elements of my story and those experiences. And so there's this level of like contraction and fear. Whereas in a ketamine experience, I'm like wide open because I feel safe with this medicine. I feel like partially removed from the intensity of the experience, where I get to kind of like survey it from a broader perspective. I don't feel taken by the intensity of it, and I can explore and I can analyze. And so it's very gentle, I'm able to do like serious work because I don't have to move through that barrier of fear initially in the journey. And so it becomes like incredibly productive.
Didn't that guy from Friends die from this?
Yeah. Yeah, so there has to be some guardrails. So
tell me a little bit about what guardrails there are, and anybody that's there tickled by doing something like this, you know, what are the risks? What do we have to be very careful about, and how do we take this incredibly serious, and how do we maintain ourselves safe?
Yeah, if there's a substance abuse issue, that's a contraindication. You know, if they have a propensity of reaching for narcotics or, you know, other dissociatives, then that's something like I wouldn't work with ketamine with that client. I would coach them, but I wouldn't use the substance. Number one. Number two, like I don't ever use it recreationally.
Do you drug test them ahead of any?
No. No, but we have
don't
like
you think that a lot of them will say I don't do anything, but on the side they're doing a ton of stuff.
Some will.
I mean, that could be for me. I mean, can you do ketamine and then do 2 hydrocodones? And then, you know...
Yeah, my patients lie to me all the time. I'm not smoking. They lie to me all the time.
Well, the pharmacy calls me. He's like, hey, this guy's got 2 prescriptions for the same drug from 3 different hospitals.
Yeah.
So I know they lie.
A lot of the ones that I work with are quite timid. They're like, they've never done psychedelics. They're afraid. They don't know what's going to happen. I find that I attract those people way more than like the partiers, you know? It's just this level of...
It's a different subset. Is there anything from the insights, you know, there are probably some things that are reproducible. There are probably some things that are that you see often as patterns. Is there any insight that you've gained that you think us, the kind of practitioners that are working with cardiovascular disease, with people that have this kind of metabolic disorder from eating, that we could learn from and we can apply in like the 15-minute outpatient visit that I get to do, or, you know, when I'm rounding in the patients that I have, when I spend like 20 minutes on them in their hospital bed? Is there something that I could learn from all the experience that you have that can somehow get to these patients that say, hey man, if you don't change, or girl, if you don't change what were you doing in a day-to-day life? You know, we're going to be here again.
Yeah. Oof. I wish that there was something I could offer you that would be so impactful that you could just deliver in a 15-minute exchange. And I guess what I feel compelled to share with you, and maybe you already carry this, but it's this level of like deep compassion. That's not necessarily going to change the outcome of your patients, but it's like nobody is carrying excess weight because of a character flaw. You know, mm-hmm. because they're like, they don't have discipline, or they're pathetic, or they're weak, or anything like that. It's because they are so dysregulated, likely, and they feel so unsafe that they are reaching for food to try to satiate that need for regulation, for comfort, for safety, for nurturance. And so, like, I don't even know, like entering into a conversation around just a deeper level of this condition, you know, bringing to their awareness that like the food is representing something, and then there's something in there for them to explore. And if they really want to change the physiology, then it's worthy of exploration. And some people will probably roll their eyes, and you may impact a few. And I think that's just the way that it goes.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm going to tell you what I think. I think nobody is... Jillian laughs like, yeah, like you haven't told us the entire show. But I really think nobody's addicted to tobacco. I don't think anybody's addicted to liquor. I don't think any of all these things.
I'm with you.
Thank you. I think there's a cause. I think there's something, you know, like what I'm trying to say is.
But what is addiction?
What I'm trying to say is it's we as doctors, here's how bad we are.
Fucked.
No. We come and we're like, listen, you've got PAD and I'm going to do all these things for you. You got to stop smoking.
Yeah.
Do you understand how fucked up that is? That we're telling that human being with emotions, with baggage, with 50, 60, 70 years of problems. And we're saying the one thing that gets you through the day, the one thing that you get to cope with, you are not allowed to take. Come on.
That's it.
Do you realize how much failure we're failing at our jobs? Because the reason why they smoke is not because tobacco is delicious. Mm. It's horrible. It stinks.
Yeah.
It's because there's something else. And that's what I was trying to say before, which is there every story starts at some point with something that pushed that human being. Their frailness, their emotional state, something, there was something that went in the wrong direction. And it's very easy to then just point fingers and say, oh, you smoke, that sucks, and you're going to die from it.
Yeah.
Like, what? Why did they get to the, like, why is that the thing they do? Why? And I know it's not practical, Lucas. That's a problem, right? I mean, when you're compensated on how many patients and surgeries you do.
Yeah.
Then you're misaligned.
That's a problem. That's
because
a huge problem.
You're only, you know, you make money by treating more people.
Yeah, but that,
and so that's but we don't care about why they got there. We're just treating a problem.
Yeah. You know, exactly.
Whatever we got to do to get their legs on. But nobody cares about the fact that they were, you know, they had an issue when they were kids.
The name of my practice is the root cause method, because I believe that trauma is the root cause of chronic illness. I go for the roots.
I thought you said garden. Wasn't it garden?
The garden is the name of the program within my practice, but the practice name is the root cause method. And I'm in there digging for the roots, and that's why it's difficult to scale necessarily. And I'm doing like group work now that is actually really powerful, because it offers some the magic of like women coming together in support of other women and being seen and what you're moving through. And it's profound. And so I'm starting to like figure out ways to impact on a larger scale. But we are literally in the dirt digging for the roots, and it's always trauma. You know, there was a study on I don't remember, like almost 800 or 900 participants with.
Please continue. Please.
I'm sorry. It was 800 or 900 participants with self-reported binge eating disorder. And it was like something, I'm botching the study, but it was like something like 75% of them reported binge eating for reasons of like hedonic hunger, which is obviously eating for pleasure, and to achieve numbness and dissociation. And this study was so interesting because it correlated certain expressions, certain reasons for binge eating with particular types of adverse childhood experiences or trauma in childhood. And they were able to like make the connection between eating for these reasons and certain trauma, such as emotional neglect, which was like the greatest one. Sexual abuse, emotional neglect. It was like people's needs not being met on an emotional level created the propensity for them to reach outside of themselves for something that created a similar feeling, that yummy, gooey comfort, nurturance with food, that it offers them something very similar on a neurological, psychological level.
But going back to what you said before, I agree.
I think you need to be more empathetic.
I am super empathetic.
No, you're very judgmental about this whole food thing.
Well, to you.
Well, what if I have issues? Like, what about my trauma?
Deal with it.
Jillian.
I think you need a string cheese affinity.
Yeah, do you need a string cheese?
Jillian, you and I are going to take this conversation offline without
judgment. I'd be happy to support you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
No, but I think that just knowing that is so. We have a good friend in common who taught me the concept of gamifying things, and I play the cigarette game with my patients. And the cigarette game is basically saying, so most people smoke, like, let's say a pack, right? Pack to have a pack. Okay. That's 20 cigarettes, right? So the cigarette game is today, this week, you're going to smoke 19 cigarettes, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. Next week, you're going to smoke 18 cigarettes, and that's fine. And then you're going to go there, and then you're going to get to the fifth week, and you're going to be smoking 5 cigarettes. And then I tell them, this is the important part. Something's going to happen that's going to piss you the fuck off. And I talked like this to mostly guys because they, mm-hmm. you know, they can relate. To kind of this kind of
girls
language.
Girls get also pissed by the
way. Yeah, but this language, this resonates a lot with guys, which I find it more difficult to connect to in a kind of more meaningful, deep way. And I tell them, okay, now it's where the important part happens. In one way, in one direction, you can say, oh, I suck. I can't do this. This is never going to work. And you can go back to smoking 20 cigarettes. And the other route is, oh, this is awesome. I got down to 15, even though I smoked, you know, 20 now because I got pissed. That means I can go lower. And you keep doing that and you keep failing at a better baseline or a lower baseline mm-hmm. until mm-hmm. you get to 2 cigarettes. I don't need you to smoke 0 cigarettes. I tell them, I don't want you to smoke 0. Really, that's not my goal. If you get from 20 to 2, I'll be really happy. So having that empathy and knowing that what makes them smoke is shit going wrong in their lives can give you a tactical tool to use
yeah.
to cause the behavior that's going to not have them have their stent go down or not have the aortofemoral bypass go down and have them die like in a horrible 60-day hospital admission.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So I think that there is probably a lot of insight.
You know what's sad about this whole thing, guys, is that us talking about it is not going to necessarily push the needle enough.
I think it is.
Enough. I said enough. I think the needle's being pushed, and I think that we're doing an incredibly important task here today. But what I'm saying is, for mass adoption, I mean, we're talking about cardiovascular disease being probably one of the main killers of human beings in the world.
That can change tomorrow.
For mass adoption, we need to have healthcare systems.
No.
Listen, that are appropriately positioned to take care of these patients' needs at the root. If I tell you today, yeah, you go and gamify your patients with your little game. That sounds great. Sounds awesome. I'm gonna do it tomorrow.
Hater's gonna hate.
No, it's not. But what I'm saying is, don't you feel that every one of your patients should probably go to therapy?
Yeah.
Don't you think that every one of your patients should probably...
Who's going to give that therapy?
That's what I'm trying to say, that unless there is the funds and the support financially to back up, the fact that these patients are needing something more than just medicine.
I think they're going to pay out of their own pocket. No, I think they're private. Won't. I think that's where the big change is going to happen. People like Jillian
is
people,
amazing, and she's got access to a whopping 0.00001% of the population that can afford her.
Yeah, but
let's be honest.
Yeah.
What she's doing is amazing, and I'll do it myself. I'll call her tomorrow and I'll start therapy to avoid my
strings.
But the fact of the matter is, what she's doing needs to go global.
Well,
unless Medicare starts paying her to do this, it's going to be very hard for us to offer it to somebody from Lufkin that works at a chemical power plant.
No, like the AI, some AI bot's going to do it.
Stop, Jillian. You will never be substituted by an AI, but not as long as I'm awake.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I know that.
No, but they're going to do part of the work for sure. They're going to do part.
I don't know.
There you go.
Great.
I flipped this whole thing over.
I think technology.
I started the victim at this thing.
No, like even now, like you're doing group work, right? You're doing, and that financially, that model works for you. You couldn't do that 10 years ago, right? So that the idea that technology isn't going to empower you to still make it financially work for you and reach more people just doesn't follow history because it does it now, right?
Mm-hmm.
20 years ago, you couldn't do 3 hours. You would have to charge so much for three hours of work. Now, if you have 20 people on, it's manageable. Mm-hmm. Because technology allows you to do that. So why wouldn't it do it in the future? You know?
Yeah, I have every intention of greater impact with group. I think group is so, so powerful.
Yeah. What if AI could read everything about you and just fucking clone you virtually? It's still you. You own it. And you fucking sell it in China in Chinese. And it's still you. Listen, you own it.
And why not? There's a point in the program that I have to say, thank you for coming. And we have to cut Lucas off because he's going on tangents.
Because you know why?
Yeah. Why?
Please answer. And then
I would rather invest a lot of my time, which I'm beginning to train other dietitians and nutritionists to do what I'm doing, because it is the human component that is the medicine. It's like the saying, like, we were wounded in relationship, so we must heal in relationship. Like in relating to other human beings and being seen and someone saying, I'm so sorry you experienced that. And like being able to actually receive that, it's, you can't prescribe a pill that does that same thing. You can't hire a bot that does that. That's medicine.
Yeah.
I think we're far, far away.
No, but that's another great, you can empathy. Probably teach, you can teach what you teach virtually using technology and then replicate that. And
I plan to.
And then you have a change, you know?
But she will not be substituted by AI.
You will not be substituted by AI. I'm sorry.
I know. Jillian, I'm grateful.
I'm incredibly grateful and honored for your presence here in our show. You will make us better people as you are making others better. I really do appreciate your time. It is the weekend. We are respectful of that. We asked for an hour. It's been an hour and 15 minutes. We could probably go on and on and on and on. But then as the show progresses,
I get crazier and crazier.
So does the derailment of cognitive processing of Lucas. And so it's important that we avoid canceling ourselves by shutting it at the appropriate time. Jillian, thank you very much.
Thank you both.
Thank you very, very
thank
much.
Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
I look forward to meeting you in person and hopefully having you.
I hope so.
A ton of more.
We are meeting in person. We're having dinner tonight.
Oh, you're in Austin?
Yeah.
Shut up.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Do I have some string cheese for you?
All right. Bye.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.